We're going to read from John chapter 1, the section of God's word that we're going to be actually reading three times and thinking about in three different ways over the next few weeks. This is the Gospel of John, then, chapter 1, verses 1 to 18. Let's hear God's word together. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. There came a man who was sent from God. His name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all men might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world. He was in the world. And though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testifies concerning him. He cries out, saying, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me, because he was before me.' From the fullness of his grace we have all received, one blessing after another. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but God the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known." The vast majority of people in this world who've ever lived believe in God. Atheism exists, of course, but you don't have to research the matter very far to realise that atheism is really quite a rare lack of belief, lack of religion. The vast majority of people in this world today, and certainly the vast majority of people who've lived in ages past, all believed that there was some kind of transcendent, unseen world behind this physical, material world that we inhabit. If you look into their vocabulary, you'll find there is a word for God there. Where human beings disagree, of course, is on exactly what God is like and how we find out about him. There have been two great competitors in the field of finding religious knowledge. Here in the West, where we live, for centuries and centuries, we've been dominated by the philosophy of rationalism. Rationalism says that the way you find ultimate truth is by the exercise of your mind, through reason. It began right back in the classical period of Greek civilization in the 4th century BC. Perhaps its greatest exponent, even still today, so many years later, was Plato, the philosopher of Greece. For Plato, the high priest, the one who had access to ultimate truth, to God, was the philosopher. The man whose brain, whose reason, was highly developed and precise. He was the one who could pierce the cloud of mystery that separates us from that invisible, eternal, spiritual world. If you were to travel to the Far East, though, you'd find a very different culture. In the Far East, mysticism has ruled men's religious aspirations and quests. Mysticism tends to view God as a kind of all-pervasive spiritual energy. And the way that you penetrate that energy or are one with that energy is not by using your mind, not through analytical reasoning, but through spiritual experience. I guess these days through New Age and all kinds of oriental groups that have made their mark on our Western world, we're familiar with yoga and meditation and all those kinds of things. These are all techniques which Eastern religion has developed as a way of leading the seeking soul to God consciousness. The interesting thing is that when you turn to the Bible, you find a third alternative, a third option being presented. Because according to the Bible, God, the ultimate truth behind things, is not some kind of rational argument or principle or theorem, such as a philosopher might discover. Nor is God some kind of impersonal energy or diffuse force permeating everything. According to the Bible, God is a personal spirit. And because he's a personal spirit, we must come to know this God, not by the use of our unaided reason, nor through mystical experience, but through faith. Faith. Personal trust, that is. The way we come to know any person. It would be a mistake to think that this faith is irrational or anti-mystical. Some people have made that mistake, but it is a mistake. Faith has an intellectual dimension to it. There have been Christian rationalists and Christian philosophers as a result of that. And faith has an experiential, you could say, mystical dimension to it. That's why there have been down through history Christian mystics. I suppose you could argue that in that sense, Christianity forms a kind of bridge between the West and the East. Maybe it's even significant that it grew up in the Middle East or the Middle West, depending on which way you're walking. On the land bridge that joins Greece to India. But it would be, I say, a mistake to think of Bible religion as if it were a compromise measure, as it were to draw the philosopher and the guru together. Now, it's very far from that. Because in spite of their differences, you see, rationalism and mysticism as ways of getting to know God have something in common. They are both, if you think about it, ladders set up on earth to reach to heaven. They are both means whereby we human beings take the initiative and search out, whether we do it by using our rational minds or by exploiting our religious emotions and intuitions. On both these views, it's up to us to find God, whatever or whoever he may be. But this religion of faith that the Bible talks about is the very opposite, you see, of that. It's concerned not with our human search for God, but with God's search for us. It tells the story of a ladder let down from heaven to earth. This religion of the Bible is not a religion of human discovery, then, but of divine initiative. Not of human attainment, but of divine condescension. Not of human research, but of divine revelation. To use the Bible's own language, it's a religion not of works, but of grace. God is not some heavenly equation that we must struggle to solve by our reasoning powers, nor is he some ocean of spiritual energy that we must try to experience by the pathway of some mystical discipline. Now, according to the Bible, God is a person to be heard. That's the key thing, a person to be heard. That's the unique thing about the God of the Bible. He speaks. He communicates. And faith is fundamentally our appropriate response to that word of self-revelation that God speaks. Now, nobody understood all this better than the Apostle John, the author of this gospel, that we're going to study just the opening fragment of over the next few weeks. John was familiar both with the philosophies of the West and the religions of the East. He knew all about rationalism, for instance, because the philosophical heirs of Plato were a very dominant force in the Greek-speaking world of the first century, where John spent a lot of his time. But John also knew a good deal about mysticism, because in the century or so before Christ, religions from the Orient had swept into the Roman Empire. Many of them were mystical religions of one sort or another, religions that invited human beings to experience union with God through some kind of ecstatic or mystical experience. So John knew about both these ways into knowing God, the rational and the mystical. And so I suppose in normal circumstances you might have expected John to be a little confused, exposed as he was to these conflicting currents of religious opinion in his day. But he was not. And the reason he was not is because something quite spectacular, something utterly unique had happened in John's lifetime, which was so tremendously important that it rendered all this religious debate that was seething in his Middle Eastern world obsolete and redundant. The heavenly logic that Plato had talked about, and the spiritual enlightenment that the mystery religions of the East talked about, John had, in a sense, found them both. Or to be more accurate, they had found John. Because this God, this personal God, who had spoken to John's Jewish ancestors centuries before, had spoken again. But this time in a new and quite revolutionary way. This God had taken a new initiative of self-revelation. A new ladder had been let down from heaven to earth. And all human beings were being called, therefore, to a new response. A new response of faith. To those who received him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to be called children of God. Well, it is that new word from heaven that we're going to be looking at in these opening verses of John's Gospel over the next 3 weeks. And this morning, we start just focusing in particular on what John tells us about the relationship between this revelatory word and creation. You see, he begins, in the beginning, quite literally, with that subject. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, he writes, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. I don't think you have to be a particularly great scholar to realize these have to be remarkable words, because they were written by a representative of one of the most fanatically monotheistic religions, peoples on earth, the Jews. The Jews confessed one God and were most emphatic about that. And John was a Jew, the author of this gospel. And yet there's no getting around the fact that in these opening verses, John is affirming that within God, there is some kind of structure of relationships. For he speaks about God and the Word was God. Notice, first of all, what he says here about the pre-existence of this Word. John doesn't say, in the beginning, the Word came into existence. If he'd meant to say that, he could very easily have said that. He would have used the past tense of the verb to become to say that. That's the very structure, the very grammar which he uses later on when he talks about the universe coming into existence. But he doesn't employ that verb or that tense. He uses here, in this very opening phrase, the imperfect tense of the verb to be. And that implies, very strongly, continuing existence. So if we wanted to be pedantic about it, we could translate that opening phrase, in the beginning, The Word was existing, was being. Now, he's talking here something about something eternal, something pre-existent. At the point when all things came into existence, he says, the world already was there. The Word was already there. Notice also the emphasis John makes on the rather special relationship between this mysterious Word and God. He says the Word was with God. Again, it's a rather interesting Greek construction. John doesn't use the preposition you'd normally expect to use denoting with. Instead, he uses a rarer word that strictly means, in normal use, motion towards someone or something. So you could, if you again wanted to be pedantic, say, and the Word was towards God. It's a very odd way of speaking. It's true that this preposition does have this force of with occasionally in the New Testament, but when it is used that way, it always seems to imply some kind of relationship between persons. Maybe the thought in the mind of a Greek when they used this preposition meaning with was something like being face to face in company with. Face to face and moving towards. It's a very relational way of expressing withness. And that's the word John uses here. The impression he seems to want to create is of intimacy and fellowship. The Word was with God. Of course, later on in this section, he spells out even more clearly what he means when he says, God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side. Notice that in verse 18. Who is at the Father's side with God. But thirdly, and perhaps most important, notice the very emphatic way in which John speaks here about the divinity of the Word. The Word, he says, was God. Now, if John had simply meant to say the Word was divine, there's a perfectly good adjective in Greek that means divine, theos, and he would have used that word. There's no way, actually, you can twist this statement, certainly not in the mouth of a Jew, with any degree of credibility, and avoid its very awkward implication. John, in spite of his monotheistic background here, is confessing that the Word was God. Any of you who've ever tried to debate the Jehovah's Witnesses may have become aware of the fact that they make a great deal of the fact that there's no definite article before the word God in the original language here. So they want to render this, the Word was a God. But again, that carries no conviction at all. For John is a monotheist. He only believes in one God. He doesn't believe in plural gods. And in any case, to say the Word was the God would probably have conveyed a mistaken impression as far as John was concerned. For it would have identified the Word and God completely without any kind of distinction of persons. And that isn't what he means. He wants to say both the Word was with God and the Word was God. He wants to get both those truths across to us. This, of course, is the material out of which the early Christians eventually came to formulate what we call the doctrine of the Trinity. There is no strictly logical way by which John's mysterious statements here, I think, can be reconciled. Certainly not with the uncompromising monotheism of first century Judaism. But then that's when it's important we remember, isn't it, that as Christians, we do not know God rationalistically. We know God by faith. We know God by responding believingly to what he reveals of himself to us. I'm quite sure these ideas that John articulates here left his intellect straining. I've no doubt he had difficulty finding exactly the words he needed to express this extraordinary new idea which had been revealed to him. But it was no good John saying, as indeed it's no good us saying, well, I can't understand this, so I can't believe it. When it comes to God, we have to believe in order to understand. Faith is the way we come to know God. Faith never calls us to abandon our reason. But especially when it comes to knowing God, faith may call us to acknowledge truths that lie beyond our reason, or at least beyond the grasp of our reason hitherto. How else could God be God, if that weren't so? And actually, it is enormously important that John unfolds this mystery of the Trinity to us in this way, that there is personal structure within God. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. Because, as Augustine many centuries ago pointed out, any other view of God can't really make sense of what John will later go on to tell us about God being love. See, God has never lacked in all eternity an object for his love. And if you think about it, love can't exist without an object. There has always been another person, a perfect reflection of God's own divine personality, an eternally begotten son, as John goes on to call him here, a son for God to love. And if that were not so, I'm not sure we Christians could affirm that love is an essential part of God's personality in the way the New Testament does when it says God is love. That's why, perhaps, if you talk to a Muslim, they find it harder to affirm God is love in quite the way a Christian can. For an isolated, unitary Allah cannot be love in this eternal and essential sense. He has nothing to love in all eternity. Only a Trinitarian God can be love in that way. Because, you see, before there was ever a sin for God to hate, there was always a son for him to love. That's why God can't forget how to love. It's built into the very structure of his own person. There is flowing constantly within God this never-ceasing dynamic of interpersonal loving relationship. And that is the mystery that John unfolds in these opening words. Hard to understand, yes. And if we insist that everything that we must believe about God must be rationalistically, logically precise, then perhaps we shall join the Jehovah's Witnesses. But the historic church has taken John's word of self-revelation here and embraced it. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. And it was through this eternal Word, John goes on, that creation came into being. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. Now, in a sense, these words would not be totally foreign, either to the Greeks or to the Jews who might have been reading John's Gospel in the first century just after he wrote it. What John is saying here would make considerable sense to them, even though there may be an element of mystery about it. Because the Greek philosophers were familiar with the idea of this divine word. Logos was the original word they used for it. And it was a word which was, as I say, familiar to them. For Plato and for the Stoic philosophers that followed him, the Logos, the word, was the kind of divine principle that imposed order on the material world, which made the material world cohere, as even we would say today, logically. The Jews, too, who might have read this, would similarly be familiar with the idea of a divine word, because these opening sentences would call to mind for them Genesis 1. In fact, John is very deliberately, I think, echoing those opening verses of the Old Testament in Genesis 1, when he says here, in the beginning. God, of course, in that opening chapter of Genesis, makes the world, very significantly, by speaking. God said, let there be light. And there was light. He created by means of his word. In a sense, John is just reaffirming that familiar thought to his Jewish readers. But of course, for him, this word has a personal identity of its own. This word was with God in the beginning. And a little later, he will share with us the even more shattering news that this word has become flesh and dwelt among us. The involvement of the eternal word in creation, again, has a lot of important consequences when you think it through. I did my early training in science, as many of you know, and it was always a very important thought to me, this, that the created universe was created through the word. See, scientists discover, don't they, a remarkable single pattern in our universe. It is a universe, not a multiverse. It's one thing. The greatest argument against pagan polytheism is modern science. For if there is a God in charge of this world, there can be only one of them. We can't any longer believe in one God in the hills and one God in the rivers and one God in the stars and so forth, because the whole universe is held together by a single coherent pattern. The same equation that describes the fall of Newton's apple describes the swing of the moon around the earth. The same equation that describes the structure of an atom describes the inferno of the sun. At the very heart of everything, there is this unifying mathematical symmetry of a most elegant kind. This delicate balance between fundamental forces and elementary particles that conspire to make our world a place of order and predictability. A place where human beings can survive and make sense of their environment. Why is it so? What's the source of this rational order and intrinsic unity in things? John insists, when you plumb the universe, as the Greek philosophers did, back to their final depths, you find not an equation, not a law, you find a personal word. He is the source of this coherence. Jesus, he says, is the logic, the wisdom, the rationality that informs the harmony of the universe. Through him, all things were made. And that's what gives great dignity, of course, to the scientist. The creation was for God, this act of self-expression. And because it was, we may look for God's signature on the world he has made. In St. Paul's Cathedral, you'll find the tomb of Sir Christopher Wren, the architect, not only of St. Paul's, but of many other churches in London. And written upon that tomb in Latin, you find the inscription, "Reader, if you seek his monument, look around you." Look around you. For Wren, you see, had expressed himself in the mighty walls and the pillars of St. Paul's that surround his tomb. He didn't need any other epitaph. In the same way, says John implicitly here, if you want evidence of God, if you want to see the signature of God's activity, look around you. For all things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that has been made. When a scientist finds logical patterns in an order in natural phenomena, he's not surprised. He has the great dignity of, as the astronomer Kepler put it, thinking God's thoughts after him. But it's not just the scientist, is it, who gains encouragement and indeed nobility from this high view of the material universe. The artist does too. One of the things that artists have struggled with all down through the centuries, again, right since Plato, is whether beauty, whether art has any kind of absolute meaning. Or does it lie all in the eye of the beholder? Are all works of art equally good or equally bad? Is it all just subjective opinion and artistic sort of taste? Or are there some absolute canons of beauty and art and meaning that rightly inform our human arts? John, I think, would be emphatically on the side of saying there is. Artistic values are not purely subjective. There is such a thing as absolute beauty. God saw that beauty when he looked at his own artistic creation on the first day and pronounced it good. And human artists, therefore, have this great dignity of reflecting the creative genius of the Word that made the world. All material things were made through him. And that's why we can appreciate them positively as artists and express their meaning and significance for us. Notice John adds, and without him nothing was made that has been made. You might think that's just repetition, just tautology, saying the same thing twice. Actually, I don't think it is. I think John there is guarding against a very persistent idea called dualism, which was certainly familiar to him in his first century Near Eastern world. Dualism, you see, is a very convenient way of explaining evil. Dualism blames all the good things that happen on God and all the bad things that happen on the devil. Dualism tells us that good and evil are equal and opposite powers, locked in this unresolvable conflict. By saying, without him nothing was made that has been made, I think John is very deliberately rejecting that kind of dualistic perspective. You see, he's going to go on to talk about the darkness. The darkness certainly exists, strange and mysterious and hostile to the light. In that sense, he's a dualist. But John will not accept that the light and the darkness are equal and opposite powers. No. Everything that exists, without exception, is the creation of the Word, including, therefore, mysteriously, whatever it is that constitutes darkness. Without him who is the source of all light, nothing was made, he says. Without him, not even the darkness could exist. And that, of course, is why the darkness is not invincible. See how he says there? The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. Or that verb could equally be translated, the darkness has not overcome it. That hope, of course, that the darkness ultimately will not overcome the light, is the spark of hope that ignites every human heart. And that's what John goes on to tell us in verse 4, and again further down in verses 8 and following. The light in him was life, and the life was the light of men, he says. John here then introduces us into his prologue, we human beings. The divine word and we human beings have something in common, life. John doesn't mean by that mere animal life, that would be a different word. No, John uses a word here which speaks of the life principle, what you might call spiritual life. Life that lifts human beings above the level of the brute beasts. The life which we have that animals don't have. And according to John, that life, that special human quality of life, illumines us like a beacon. It beckons us to some finer destiny. The life was the light of men. We all know about this, of course, don't we? We all know that there is a kind of spiritual dissatisfaction and restlessness in our souls that marks us out from the animal world. Unlike the animals, we're not content just to survive, not to just improve our material standard of living. We are looking for something else. We do not live by bread alone. Well, says John, it is that divine word through which all the worlds were made that we human beings are longing for with such an insatiable appetite. There is something in our very psyche that resonates with that divine word and illuminates our inner life. Notice John says in verse 9, this light is all human beings without exception. The true light that gives light to every man, he says, was coming into the world. This is part then of our common human heritage. And this, of course, is why we are religious creatures. This is the root of all our religious searchings. This is why some embark in rationalism and some embark on mysticism. This is why we are looking for answers. We are by nature religious animals, because the life is the light of men. Haven't you sometimes felt this? Haven't you sometimes just been struck by how utterly extraordinary it is that you exist? That you have some kind of understanding, some kind of consciousness in this chaos of matter of which the world is made. Hasn't the bewildering mystery of it all ever grabbed you deep down? Like a candle inside our hearts, it summons us to find some explanation for the uniqueness of our humanity. If we were computers, we wouldn't think this way. No computer looks at the world and says, surely there's a meaning to it all. No computer examines its circuitry and says, oh, I must be here for a purpose. But we do. We human beings do. Because the life was the light of man. And that, of course, is why Christmas is such a special time. It's a special time for all of us who are looking for answers. Why am I on this planet? Why are any of us here? Why am I to the millions of lifeless, unpopulated universes that might have resulted from that big bang the scientists tell us about? Why did this universe emerge? Why did human beings emerge? Why am I here? Those are the really big questions of life, aren't they? In his novel Nausea, Jean-Paul Sartre depicts a man who comes upon, I think it's a cherry tree or a chestnut tree in bloom. And for a moment he's completely mesmerized by the beauty of this tree. And then suddenly he's overcome by a thought of the meaninglessness, the uselessness, the futility of life. And he asks himself, what am I being so hypnotized by? It's nothing but a huge, sick joke, this cherry tree, this beauty I'm admiring. It means nothing. The universe means nothing. Hence the name for that novel, Nausea. The man is nauseated. In the pit of his stomach, he feels this deep sickness. Because that which he had so admired and so and been so enthralled by could, at the end of the day, be simply chaos and chance and meaninglessness. But that's the conclusion the author Sartre had come to, of course, about the universe. John gives us a better view of the world. He tells us we're on this planet asking why, because we ourselves are created by this word. Those unanswered whys that buzz in our minds are there because we're not animals. We are human beings. And the life is the light of man. And there is not one of us here, there is not one human being on this planet who hasn't been illumined in some way by that light that beckons us to search for answers. And on the first Christmas day, a group of shepherds, and later a group of wise men from the east stumbled on that very meaning, on that very truth, on that light of the world. For the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. Next week, we'll think more about it. Let's pray together.